This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Majora Carter, a leading urban revitalization strategy consultant, real estate developer, and Peabody Award-winning broadcaster. Founder of Sustainable South Bronx, Majora is responsible for the creation and implementation of numerous green infrastructure projects, policies, and job training and placement systems. She has received many awards, including a MacArthur Genius Fellowship, and her company, Majora Carter Group, was named a B Corporation Best for the World 2014 consulting company. Majora Carter is here to tell us about urban revitalization and how to incorporate equity into neighborhood development. Welcome, Majora.
Thank you for having me.
What led to your interest in urban revitalization and environmental justice?
Well, I grew up in the South Bronx in New York City, which when I was growing up, one could call it the poster child for urban blight, and that was certainly the way that we were viewed in the media. You know, there was the big era of financial disinvestment. So the community that my dad moved into back in the late 1940s, you know, that was a thriving walk to work community and, you know, the kind of place that, you know, really it was a working middle class and middle class community. All that kind of went out the door when the financial disinvestment came, redlining came, white flight happened, and that thriving working and middle class community kind of just disappeared because landlords started torching the buildings to collect insurance money because banks were making it so you couldn't find investment to put back into your properties. I grew up watching that happen, buildings burn, people leaving, seeing it on the nightly news, really feeling that there was no value in the community. This was not a place I wanted to stay. And I started planning my escape through education. And after that, when I only had to come back home because I was starting graduate school and I was going to NYU, I had to stay at my parents' house because I was broke. And that's when I started to get involved in the solid waste management issue because the city was planning to actually create more waste facilities within the South Bronx. And it would have brought an enormous amount more of waste facilities to the community. And it just became clear to me that this was happening here, like our ability to care for ourselves economically and socially were being compromised by the environmental issues that we were being forced to deal with. And I wanted to be a part of making lives different and better for the people in our community.
Well, you've begun alluding to this, but what did you observe about equity when you were growing up?
Well, I saw that just from the financial disinvestment standpoint, the fact that our communities were redlined by banks, which means they weren't investing in them, that there were very few, you know, kinds of economic developments that actually brought jobs to the community. So those places that were left open became the places where environmentally burdensome facilities like waste facilities and then later on power plants and sewage sludge pelletizing plants would come into those communities. And so these things would come into our community because we happen to be a poor community of color. Just nationally, that's what we see. The poorer and the darker the community, the more environmental burdens. It's politically expedient to put those types of facilities there. So it was clear that this was a problem. So it was inherently disproportionate, the amount of environmental burdens that we had in comparison to the kind of environmental benefits that wealthier and usually whiter communities got to experience.
What does environmental justice mean to you?
The definition that I use is that environmental justice is the concept that, you know, no one community should bear the brunt of environmental burdens and not have any access to environmental benefits. But unfortunately, race and class have everything to do with where you'll find the environmental benefits and the environmental burdens.
So what was it that actually prompted you to try to take steps to change your neighborhood?
Well, seeing that our city and our state were just absolutely discriminating against our community. So it wasn't like we weren't handling our own fair share of environmental burdens. We were. At that point, we were handling about 40% of the city's commercial waste and 100% of the Bronx's waste. And their plan would have brought another 30 to 40% of the city's waste to our community as well. And we were just like, that's just insane. Like, why isn't Manhattan taking care of their own waste? And it was just like, well, because they're Manhattan, and, you know, that's where wealthier and whiter people live. And it's like, well, this is a problem. Because again, a community, a city, I think is only as strong as the weakest part of the community, this entire city that's there. So the idea that you could think that it's perfectly okay to continue to do that was just crazy to me. So I was really interested in, you know, sort of recognizing that as a community, you know, we were demoralized. We were demoralized because of the fires. We were demoralized because the media had presented us as like an awful place where nothing good happened. And then we've got this issue with all this garbage in our community. And of course, that's what people thought, you know, about poor dark people, you know, as if we had anything to do with planning our community that way. It was just crazy. So my work and where I really decided I wanted to propel myself to was actually providing alternatives for the way we were perceived as a community by taking the same land and using it in a different way, in a way that it provided value and beauty for us.
Could you say specifically the projects that you took on?
Sure. One of my favorites is transforming a dump into a park, actually a national award-winning park, and it dead-ended at the Bronx River. And I didn't even know there was a real river. I mean, I knew there was a river in our community because I saw it on a subway map, but you couldn't get to the river because there was all of this industry that lined it. And had if there not literally been a map city street that went to this one area that had actually been used for about 30 years as a city dump, and if I hadn't gotten wind of a very small seed grant project from the U.S. Forest Service where they wanted folks from urban areas with threatened rivers to actually do restoration projects on them, if I hadn't gone looking, I probably wouldn't have known that it was there or that it could have been used as a way to revitalize our community. So we did a series of cleanups. We worked with industry and government and, of course, the local community to help transform that place into what was a dump, literally, into what is now this beautiful national award-winning park that people in our community are just so delighted to have.
What are your thoughts on the interplay between environmental and a neighborhood's economic and social concerns?
Oh, I think that the environmental and social and economic issues in communities are completely tied up. I believe that when you have an economically disempowered community, that's when the social issues, you know, start to happen. And it's also when the environmental ones happen, because if people don't feel as though they have anything to look forward to, it becomes much more difficult for them to advocate for themselves and to really work in place to support that community. Because what we're often told in low-status communities is that we're supposed to measure success by how far we get away from them. We're not intended to actually make investments in them. We're not intended to, you know, actually be there for the future of that community. That's someone else's job. And so that's why, you know, when people, and they're always talking, I think, about gentrification as if it just happened. Gentrification doesn't just happen. I think gentrification, it doesn't start happening when doggy daycares and, you know, white people move into formerly communities of color that were considered marginalized. It doesn't just happen then when you start noticing those things. It starts happening, you know, when we tell smart, hardworking kids of years and years ago to measure success by how far they get away from those communities. When we, through certain and uncertain terms, tell people that those communities aren't anything of value and you should do whatever you need to do to get out of it. So the people who are the income generators, the people that normally would be considered the aspirational role models of a community, when they leave, what you're creating is a reinvestment gap, which makes it easier for developers to come from the outside, buy up property cheap, and there's people are selling it cheap because they've not been led to believe there's any real value in it. And, you know, God forbid, there is actually support, whether it's from the government or from philanthropy, that's actually helping the people that own property in those communities develop it on their own so that they could be a part of an economic development trend that's going on there. What we see is instead those folks from outside come in and invest, and suddenly then that's gentrification. But again, it doesn't just start at that point. It starts long ago. So what we're trying to do is actually something called self-gentrification, where we believe that we should be doing development that is by us and for us in our communities. It doesn't mean that we won't welcome in folks, because I believe in economic diversity as well. And I think just poor communities are horrible communities. Like, that's why poor people don't want to live in them. The second they get to the point where they're not poor, they leave. So we have to seriously think of that and figure out ways that actually provide the kind of economic and social and environmental transformation in all communities.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Majora Carter, a leading urban revitalization strategy consultant and founder of Sustainable South Bronx. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. Say more about your thoughts about the best ways to revitalize disadvantaged urban areas to go about improving a neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So much of our approach is really rooted in the idea that, you know, we kind of look at communities, in particular low-status communities, as corporations. You know, the same way that if you're a corporation or company, you want to retain your good talent. And you do what you need to do because you need people to stay with you so that they can actually help you build your business, and you want to keep them happy so that they're not checking out and doing other jobs really quickly. If we think of communities as corporations, you want your best talent to stay. And so what do they need? If you're doing just a company, you want them to get good salaries, but there's also the other added benefits. Maybe it's, you know, a good time off policy. You know, maybe it's a ping pong machine, you know, in the break room. Maybe it's like free snacks. Who knows? Whereas in a community, what are the things that keep people in a community? Oh, well, first of all, good housing, right? It's got to be attractive and safe and clean and all that good stuff. But there's also like what happens in the third spaces outside of your home. Is there nice open space, which we know is a great democratizer when you don't need money to enjoy it? And then there's the kind of shops and other economic developments, whether it's cafes or bookstores or restaurants or even just good libraries and, of course, good schools and things of that nature. Those are the type of things that you realize if you have those things in those communities, people are less inclined to leave. They also feel as though they've got something to lose if they leave the neighborhood like that. So they're invested, not just through their dollars, but also emotionally, because this is a great place that actually feeds their needs as well as their desires in terms of the quality of life that they want to live. So in low-status communities, the kind of real estate development that we do is all about creating the kind of developments that increase economic diversity by retaining the talent that literally has been taught from the time they were little, that they should grow up and leave neighborhoods like this. And what we do is create the kind of developments that encourage people to want to stay and physically and emotionally invest in our communities so that they can be the aspirational role model, so that they are circulating their dollars throughout their own community. And, you know, creating that kind of buzz, you know, first for the people that are there, but also for visitors that come and hopefully spend money in those neighborhoods, which, of course, just help increase the amount of dollars that circulate throughout that community.
How about the residents that are quite low income? And if the prices start to go up, then what happens to them?
Look, I mean, that will happen. But the other part that's also often forgotten about in terms of any kind of gentrification discussion is that if you don't create the kind of economic developments for folks, there will be no chance for people to move out of being low income. So our approach really does include not just the housing, but also different economic developments, really investigating what are the economic trends in a region and working to prepare people to participate in them. Like, we've done that in terms of looking at the tech economy and knowing full well that we are now, like this country, as is the world, we are totally digital, period. And so this idea of a digital divide isn't just about people getting broadband. It's literally about whether or not people, are they simply consumers of technology or are they producers? And are we preparing people to be producers? And so we've actually come up with a market-based solution that actually provides people in our communities an opportunity to participate in the tech economy through a tech social enterprise that actually sells a service to area software developers in New York City. And that is often the first job that folks, you know, from communities like ours have in the tech economy, which provides career ladders into it.
Say more about that project and how you started it.
It's called Startup Box. We started it as a project that was incubated under a nonprofit that I run, but because we thought it was just going to be sort of like a typical kind of workforce development model. So initially we started out teaching high school kids to code, realized there was a lot of other people doing that, so we didn't need to. And then we thought about, you know, can we encourage tech companies to come to the South Bronx? And we realized no, because we don't have the kind of community that people would really want to come to. There weren't cool places to shop. There weren't great coffee shops. We just created a coffee shop, actually, almost a year ago. So now we do have good coffee, but, you know, no restaurants, no nothing like that. And it was also the perception that it was a dangerous neighborhood, even though actually crime rates have been going down every single year for a long time. But what we did was we looked around. We knew that we needed to get people hired in the tech economy. So we did almost 2 years worth of market research to sort of see where the gaps were. Like, could we actually come up with our own business that provided a service to folks so that we could actually not just train and pray that our people get hired by somebody, but that we could train our people to do a service. And then our company, the people in our company, would literally come in direct contact with our clients. And that would be a way for folks to be hired away from us. So we provided a service in quality assurance or software testing, which is a part of the software development pipeline that tests software. Basically, someone designs a piece of software, somebody's got to test it. The same way someone writes a book, an editor just checks it and edits it to make sure that it's hitting its mark. Same thing in software. But that's a really interesting way for folks to get a sort of firm foothold in the idea of software development. And you learn about the way things don't work. So learning about product failure is a good thing. Understanding market insights of how to do this kind of work is great. And because, again, the folks that we worked with, despite the statistical hiring bias in tech around from white women and also for people of color, this was not a way to make people feel guilty about, you know, we've got to bring, you know, a woman or a person of color into our team. Instead, this was like, we're providing a service for you, and then you get to see who's providing that service that basically made your job easier. And then you get to see how people work. And then after that, you know, our hope was to have people hired away from us, which was what we're experiencing.
How large is Startup Box?
So we've been around since 2012. We've got about almost 10 employees. They periodically move on, and so we're trying to keep, you know, people in. But it's a B2B or business-to-business service, so it's as the work comes in, but it's really exciting.
How do you go about choosing your employees?
We've done some really interesting recruitment techniques because, again, if you're living in a very low-status community, people are demoralized in some ways. And I think if we had said to folks, actually we know because we tried it, if we'd said to folks, hey, you know, we've got a tech job for you, most people would kind of automatically self-select out because their confidence level was not high in many ways. And they were just like, tech is something that people do downtown. It's not something that we do up here. So what we did was actually host gaming tournaments, which if you're not a gamer, most people wouldn't know that people competitively game, like literally will sit in a room together or online and actually compete through gaming. And it's a really fascinating experience because I didn't realize like how social it was. So we would host these gaming tournaments, you know, and offer just small cash prizes, and people would come to participate. But it was a great personality screen because you could see someone who was playing a game, you know, like, were they a team player? Like, were they actually willing to offer up tips even to their competitor? Like, oh, you could have used the joystick differently this way and it would have made it a little easier for you, blah, 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 that kind of stuff. But once we saw that, you know, we would tap someone on the shoulder and say, hey, you know, you're really good at this, and we've got a tech job that you could be good for because so many of our clients at the time thought many of our clients were going to be game developers. So immediately people were like, you know, their confidence was high, and they were like, sure, I could do that. And that's how we initially recruited.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Majora Carter, a leading urban revitalization strategy consultant and founder of Sustainable South Bronx. So how receptive have businesses been to your services and to signing on?
Of course, we can use a big sales team, which would be awesome. But absent of that, you know, we definitely make the rounds in conferences and, you know, word travels by word of mouth. And, you know, we've been able to keep a steady flow of people working with us, which has been great. We're really interested in taking this model across the country because any place where there is a low-status community, which we know are actually very tech-savvy, and where there's a thriving tech sector, we think that this kind of service and their various software services that could be provided locally to those local software developers, and we think this could be a great way to help diversify the tech economy, but in a way that actually makes sense. Again, it's not a way to guilt anybody into doing it. It's really a way to provide service and to create more measurable businesses within the tech economy locally.
So have you started connecting with people in other locations already?
Yeah, we've actually gotten some interest from places in Philadelphia and the Twin Cities, a couple cities in Texas, Seattle, Oakland. Yeah, so who knows? Maybe we'll see things happening around here too.
What is the mission of your consulting company?
Our goal really is to provide both our clients and now our company as a real estate developer. We provide our communities that we work with the kind of project-based, sustainable environmental and economic development that is transformative. And we do it through a variety of means, but mostly through economic development goals and tools.
What types of clients do you usually work with?
A lot of universities, businesses, and corporations, primarily those two. Primarily those two. And of course, I'm my worst client because I realize that I prefer being a practitioner way more than I prefer being a consultant. And that's why we're focusing on developing our own projects.
What would be a specific example of a project you've done with a client?
With a client, let's see. Okay, so I'll give one from back east. We worked on helping a company that was online grocer move. They were planning on moving from one part of New York City to another part of New York City. And there was a bit of controversy because there was some social justice activists who didn't want them to move on environmental grounds. And there were other groups that felt that they could work with this company for the exact same reason, but for different reasons, but coming at it from opposite sides. So we were able to help folks in the local community come to agreement to work with a company to make sure that there were the type of jobs that they wanted to see happening, that there was opportunities for local food access that they wanted to see happen, and also some other environmental issues that they wanted them to address. You know, so hundreds of people have been hired. There's definitely better access for local food within the community, and just any kind of food because it's an online grocer, so it's totally delivery-based. So we were really excited about that because, again, everybody wasn't always happy, but there were plenty of folks that were. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people who were really happy with the development of creating more access to healthy, decent food within a community and also job creation.
What are your thoughts about how to best incorporate equity into addressing climate change in the U.S.?
I think the best way to incorporate equity in climate change is to recognize the link between jobs and the environment. Because I really feel like what the environmental movement has done long term, you know, in the past, has not really, let me go back a little bit. I think there's a reason why the environment ranks so low on the general public's list of issues. And in part because it does feel like it's this thing that happens over there, either it happens in the wilderness or it really doesn't have anything to do with their daily experience. People will listen to the rhetoric because it's loud and interesting about coal is going to save America. I think that there have been a lot of folks within the environmental movement, you know, who are really very smart, but not necessarily in terms of changing the hearts and minds of people who need some relief. And I really do believe that if we, you know, had bothered to meet people where they were and address some of their very serious issues around the economy and how, if we were more deliberate about it, how we can actually use the renewable energy economy, green infrastructure, even sustainable food systems as ways to really support people through their economic quality of life, whether it's through job creation and business development, because linking that together, I think is good, especially the folks that are in marginalized communities and low status communities. Again, I don't care what color it is, because if we went to coal mining country and helped with the kind of investments that would actually be invested in renewable energy infrastructure down there so that people could get jobs and wind power in coal country, I don't think they'd be talking so much about coal. But we're not really pushing too much of that, as far as I can tell. And I think that those are the kind of things that we need to be more focused on.
What are your plans for the future? Where do you plan to focus your efforts?
I'm really interested in proving out models for real estate development and using it as a tool for social, economic, and environmental transformation in low-status communities. I believe in using mixed-income housing and mixed-use commercial development as strategy tools to create the kind of economic diversity that helps make people understand that they actually are the tools to their own recovery. It's through creating jobs. It's about creating the kind of places that are safe and healthy. It's about creating better access to open space and local economic developments that actually allow dollars to circulate throughout the local economy more than once, which is generally the way that it does in most low-status communities. We know the more it circulates, the healthier a community actually is in every single way, not just economically. So that's what I'm working on. So our first project was the development of the first coffee shop, which was a third space, like a third community space within the neighborhood I was born and raised in. We just financed a restaurant as well, which will be one of the first to happen in our community like that. You know, we lose a lot of culinary talent that's born and raised in the Bronx, and because there isn't a place for them to operate, but we want to really figure out ways to keep that local, you know, and hopefully we'll be acquiring some other property to do a much, much larger scale development with mixed income housing and mixed use commercial development that on the commercial side will have tech and arts as well as retail spaces in it, and then opportunities for low income home ownership and also mixed income rentals.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
The message I'd love to leave your listeners with is you don't have to move out of your neighborhood to live in a better one, but you got to have a plan to make sure that it gets better.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Majora.
Thank you.
You are just listening to Majora Carter, a leading urban revitalization strategy consultant and founder of Sustainable South Bronx. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening. And be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and on kexp.org.